Right, good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. I'll return the homework and then there are two problems.
Actually, three, but I will make a brief remark. I've also put total points on as far as my spreadsheet calculated them.
What is it out of?
Will be the next sentence.
Okay.
I mean, it's currently out of 48. With the homework, there is one homework which is currently out, which is due the not this Friday, not next Friday, but the Friday afterwards. And there will be one more homework. So in total, my guess is there will be 68 or 69, certainly less than 70 problems in total, which means that with the 80% rule, about 55, 56 will count as 100%.
Can you get above 100?
Yes.
That will not
make up for the exam. But you can get over 100, yes. I'm not sending the back and saying no, you. Good. Next remarks about the homework. Yes, the one problem about the stable matching, you all got this, that there are two different, that the outcome is differently depending how you run it. And that's an example where you can design things mathematically nicely, but depending on the context, that might not solve the problem. If you imagine that these are now not teachers in classes, but I don't know, people in protected categories, and you assign them to certain tasks or so, this could potentially get you into serious trouble by not considering other conditions about equal treatment or so. So that's some. Or at the least, you might have people unhappy, even though it's a perfect solution. So there sometimes is still a step from a nicely defined solution to something which really is a general acceptable. Second remark, the problem about characterizing bipartite graphs. The solutions I saw, they were correct. They were just a little bit long. And so the way I would have proven the problem is basically to say I fix one vertex, and let's say this would be okay. So if it is bipartite that the cycles have even length, that's clear. It's the other direction, which is slightly interesting. Pick one vertex, and let's say without a loss of generality, this is in component one. And now you just show that every vertex has a, let's call it a parity, which depends on how far is this vertex from this one chosen vertex. What's the distance? Is the distance even length or odd length? You show that this is uniquely defined. Why is it uniquely defined? Because if it wasn't, you would have a path, two paths of length, where one is even, one is odd, and you go around and you have a cycle of odd length. So this parity is clear, and then you just say those with even parity are in the one component, those with odd parity are in the other component. And I think that is shorter. It's perfectly fine, and it's not that you have to come up with the shortest possible proof, but at some point you might want to think about this is something, well, towards the end of your first year, as a graduate student, where you might want to start also looking at how do I write a proof down effectively, because at some point you don't want to spend pages and pages on something which you can do in a few lines. That's just to save your own time. What I wanted to say with the first problems, if there is a calculation problem, some of you basically gave me the solution and I gave the points there, that's fine, but in the final exam I would like to see some indication of how a calculation is done. not just here is the solution. Okay, then one problem which, well, I wouldn't say surprising, but which turned out a bit difficult, is the one about that every minimum cut must be at capacity. And that initially looks like, isn't this obvious? Isn't this trivial? What do we need to show? But if you look at the way how we define things, we said the capacity, we showed on the one hand the capacity of a maximal flow is equal, the value of a maximal flow is equal to the capacity of a minimal cut. And we had a process which finds a maximal flow and at the same time finds a maximal cut. But what now, at least in the end the problem is about showing that it can't happen, but what you could theoretically imagine is you have some, well, let me not draw the cut as a set of vertices, but let's just draw the cut as something which goes along certain edges. You could have some cut here, and you could have some cut here. They could overlap. And what you need to show is that if you have a flow, every minimal cut is at capacity. Or you could have another cut which sits later down here. Right? So the question is to show that really every cut, regardless where it is at capacity, and what could happen, is it possible that some cuts share edges or so? And that makes the situation a little bit messy. So why is this the case? There are basically two ways how you can prove it. One is to use the lemma we had about the value of a flow that we can measure it anywhere, that we can measure it at any cut. That's immediately a consequence of this, of that lemma, because we just say, okay, measure the flow and it will be everywhere like this. Or you can use even shorter max flow min cut, namely, suppose that was a cut, the red was a cut, minimal cut, and we have a maximal flow, so at that cut, the flow is there. If this other cut is not at capacity in that flow, I could reduce the capacity of one of the edges and thereby make that cut smaller, making it the minimal cut. And then the minimal cut would be smaller than the maximum flow. So that can't happen. Therefore, every minimal cut must be at full flow when we have a maximum flow. Okay. Right. Yeah, so that was what I had as remarks about the homework. Are there questions?
I hope you didn't answer this right before I went in, but how many points have been possible so far? 48
are possible so far, and I expect the maximum possible in the semester will be around 68 or 69.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Then the current homework is a lot. The current homework has 12 problems. Yeah.
Right, and it's like 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's why it gets so high.
Thanks. Sorry if that's...
That's fine. And yes, it was the question. I just...
Of course.
Other questions? No?
So this is your last class teaching? Or?
No, I teach till Wednesday.
Okay.
And then on Thursday evening I'll fly.
Where are you off to?
To India, to Bangalore.
Cool. All
right.
What for? Conference?
Conference, yeah.
Just for pleasure.
Yeah. And it probably would be not in the middle of the country, but somewhere on the beach. But yeah, that's.
there is. Well, if you make that remark, let me just look for this. Because that is a cute joke. Pass that around.
Is it worth it?
It's worth it, yes.
Yeah. Do these notes cover the rest of the semester?
In principle, yes. Yeah, if you have that will be the rest of the semester.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that will come out reasonably for the semester.
Okay.
We're going to have to email that to everyone.
Sorry, I know this is slightly stupid. Anyhow, so. What we have done is we started looking at partitions, and our goal is to get some idea about how many partitions are there. Partitions where I don't care in which order the cells are given, how many partitions are there for a given A. And as I mentioned already, we will not be able to get perfectly a number, but we will get some reasonable recursion. Reasonable in the sense of that one can use it to calculate and that one can also use it to prove things with it. So, because this is obviously related to partitions, we did something about pentagonal numbers last time. And that was a theorem which I would expect in several ways was surprising. First, why on earth, what do the pentagonal numbers have to do there? And the other thing which is somehow weird is the proof. You have three cases, but you don't prove them this way, you prove them this way. And you just say, oh, that's all the cases and that's what must have happened. So I really like that proof as something, wow. What, and you just see, yes, there is a reason that Euler is famous. So what I now want to do is I want to, go back to the generating function for partitions. We knew that, right? So we had from last time the generating function for partitions was the product 1 minus t to the minus I, right? Wasn't that? Oh no, sorry, we had t to the I to the minus, t to the I to the minus 1.
Notes
are floating around the class. Yeah. Okay. So. No. Sorry. I don't need the minus one. It will be 1/1 minus. If I. So the formula is minus 1. Okay. And now I will look at the reciprocal of this. And that's why the minus 1 is not there. So that, but that's where it is related. And what I will also do, just to simplify dealing with pentagonal numbers, I will use a short, this is just notational shortcut. I will write omega of k is shall be k times 3k minus 1 over 2 for k in the integers. And if I put arbitrary integers in, that formula gave us all the pentagonal numbers. And we could instead put a plus here, and then we would take this function, the function with a plus, and only take the non-negative integers. That's an alternative way of doing it. Right, so what I now claim And I will review the statement of Euler's theorem while going through the proof of this theorem or this corollary. And that's corollary 5.5. If I look at the reciprocal of this, so I have the product n greater or equal than 1, 1 minus t to the n, I claim this is the sum k goes from minus infinity to infinity, minus 1 to the k, t to the omega of k. And what I can do is I can, so let's look at what would be omega of minus k. Omega of minus k would be minus k times minus 3k minus 1 divided by 2, and I can simplify this. If I put the minus sign in there, I get k times 3k plus 1 over 2. So I get this other formula if I plug in minus k. Right? So, and what I claim is I can instead of having a sum which is doubly infinite, I can have a sum over k is, well, 1 plus, that's the 0 term, and then k is greater than 0. Why do I separate it? Because 0 is once and all other numbers exist twice, an absolute value. T to the omega of k plus t to the omega of minus k. Okay, so that is just separating this sum into positive and negative part. Okay. Right. So that's what I want to prove. So let even of n be the number of partitions of n into an even number, into an even number of distinct parts, and odd of n is the number of partitions in odd number of distinct parts. And then I know from Euler's theorem that we have even of n minus odd of n. They are equal if the number is not pentagonal, and so they're equal otherwise. When is the difference? When is even more? This is 1 if n is equal to omega of k for k even, and it's minus 1 if n is equal to omega of k for k odd. Right? That was the statement in a compact form, the statement of Euler's theorem. So, what do I have on the right-hand side here? Well, this is like a generating function, right? This is a generating function where the terms only occur for cases if I have a pentagonal number, all other coefficients are zero. And what are the coefficients if I have pentagonal numbers? If k, if it's a pentagonal number for k even, I get 1. If it is a pentagonal number for k odd, I get minus 1. Right? So, the right-hand side is the is a generating function. So, therefore, the right-hand side is a generating function for even of n minus odd of n. So, what I just need to show is that's what the left-hand side does. Right? Because generating functions are unique. Two power series are equal if their coefficients are equal. Then I'm done. So, show that the same holds for the left-hand side. That the same holds for the left-hand side. So, what do I have on the left-hand side? On the left-hand side, I will get a power series, and I will get terms. When do I get t to the n on the left hand side? On the left hand side, get t to the n as a product t to the n1 times t to the n2 and so forth, times t to the nk. K probably not, let's say t to the nl, where n is the sum over those ni's. Okay, and what does this partition contribute? Well, it actually is a minus 1, right? Because I have minus t, I have a minus 1 to the L. So that contributes minus 1 to the L. Okay. And furthermore, what can I tell about these ni's? Can some of these ni's be equal? You're shaking your head. Why not?
Because they're appearing from terms in this product, and we don't have the
yes.
same power choice.
Right? They need to be all different. And I can order them if I want in descending order or so, and consider them as unique by just looking at the factors where I choose t. So I have partition into distinct parts with L parts, and that contributes minus 1 to the L. Well, that is exactly a generating function for even of n minus odd of n, right? Because if I, for any partition with an even number of parts, I get 1. For every partition with an odd number of parts, I get minus 1. So, let's get 1 for every partition with even
number of parts and minus one for every partition with an odd number of parts. So what I'm counting there is even of n minus odd of n. So that's the same generating function. And that's the left-hand side, and there the right-hand side was that generating function. Therefore, left-hand side and right-hand side have to be. And that's all we had to show. So that proves this corollary. Right. So, with this, we can now prove a recursion formula for P of N. So, another corollary, 5, 6. P of n is the sum over k greater than 0 minus 1 to the k minus 1. Okay, and now I get P of n minus omega of k plus P of n minus omega of minus k. And I can write this out by just looking what are the values I get for omega. So this is P of n minus 1 plus P of n minus 2 minus P of n minus 5 minus P of n minus 7 plus P of n minus 12 and so forth. And I get these pentagonal numbers somewhere there as shift values in the recursion. Okay. Yeah. So, that's a recursion formula. It's a recursion formula which, if you have a concrete n, you can use this to calculate the value for P of n recursively. Yes, you need at the same time calculate what are these pentagonal numbers, but that's not very hard to do. So this is, if you want, this is something which isn't hard to implement as a function. If you want to have a count of partitions, it doesn't have a closed form, unfortunately, and you can also use it to prove some results about partitions. But let's first prove this result here. So we knew what I just erased, what the generating function for partitions is, right? That's the product, so we have the sum P of n, t to the n is the product over 1 minus t to the I to the minus 1. And I realize that I'm really good at switching the index variable without any justification or reason. Okay, so we know what the reciprocal of this is. This was just the prior corollary. So, what I claim is, therefore, if I take this generating function, sum over n, p of n, t to the n, and I multiply it with the result from the previous corollary, that was 1 plus the sum k greater than 0 minus 1 to the k, to the omega of k plus t to the omega of minus k, that product is 1. That's just saying one is the inverse of the other one. Okay. But I can, on the other hand, look at this as an identity about generating functions.
right? Here I have two generating functions and have their product. And what is the product? The product is a generating function which has a constant term 1 and all other terms, all other coefficients are 0. So, what I will do is I will look at coefficients of t to the n in this product. So, in this product, the coefficient of t to the n is 0 for n greater or equal than 1. And that's the right-hand side, because it's 0 times t to the n there. Okay. So, what is it on the left-hand side? On the left-hand side, when I multiply this out, what do I get? Well, I get either t to the n completely from here, then I get p of n. So the right hand side, no, sorry, left hand side is. Left hand side will be p of n, okay, plus. And now I will get these terms. I can get a t to the n from some t to the something here and some t to the something here. Right? And so I get this sum. I get the sum k greater than 0 minus 1 to the k p of n minus omega of k plus, there should be parentheses there, p of n minus omega of minus k. Okay, so why is this the case? Well, to have the term for omega of k contribute in total to t to the n, I need to have n minus omega of k here, right? And then the index here is simply n minus omega of k. And similarly for omega of minus k. And they both contribute a minus 1 to the k. So that is, well, and we know this sum is equal to 0. Yeah, and now we use that p of n is equal to 0 for n smaller or equal than 0. That is, and we now, if we want this form, we just substitute the values for the pentagonal numbers, and that's it. That is this formula. Yeah. So this is a recursion one can use, for example, to, as I mentioned, to calculate values for p of n. One can use it to do estimates of the growth for p of n. And it turns out one can, some of the things which one can prove for p of n really aren't any longer lying in combinatorics, but are basically getting into the area of number theory. So let me just, without proving them, because the method for proving it uses very different techniques. It uses modular forms, which is some more advanced number theory. So let me just note this, and these are formulas which are due to Ramanujan. We have that p of 5n plus 4 is congruent to 0 modulo 5. P of 7n plus 5 are congruent to 0 modulo 7. Or p of 11n plus 6
are congruent to 0 modulo 11.
And these are the only three which hold so nicely. One can generalize it, but then things get more complicated. And it took quite a while to find out generalizations. But yeah, these are somehow nice and easy looking identities. It is very much not obvious why these identities should hold.
Unless you like hear the voice of God speaking into your ear and telling you to demand.
Because you don't even, I mean, okay, 5 and 7, okay, 5 and 7 you have here, but why 11? Why not 12? Yeah. So, these hold, but with this really we are already quite a bit in number theory. The other thing, and I won't write this on the board, is one can generalize Euler's theorem and get something which is called the Jacobi triple product identity, which looks initially a little bit scary, but basically that is something which is used in the theory of theta functions, and theta functions are exactly what number theory uses there, and theta functions is something which physics uses. So we are here at a point where in some way we are turning back into the land of combinatorics, but where there would be bridges out to number theory, to physics, which would show again that these are objects and ideas which are very central to mathematics. Okay. Yeah, so that's about counting partitions. What I now want to do is I want to do a little bit more with partition, more, not just time-wise more, but I mean we will basically be spending the rest of the semester with partition, and please don't be scared by that. But also not just look at partitions, but do a little bit more with them. And that's the next... Oh, sorry, we just asked questions. No? And that will be the next section. Section 3. Paragraph 3, which is about tableaus. Okay. Tableau is French plural. The word, French word originally is tableau. And tableau means board, like blackboard. And tableau just is the plural, so these are things where one can write something on or something in. And what I want to do is, I want to look at a partition. I want to look at the Young diagram of the partition. So let me probably start first with an example. I take the partition 5, 4, 2, 1. I draw its Young diagram. Okay, and I put numbers. Okay. So, if I have a partition of n, if I put the numbers in and I want to put in the numbers from 1 to n. If I put them in arbitrarily, I have n factorial possibilities. There is not much to do. So, what I want to do is, I want to be a bit more restrictive how I put the numbers in, and that's what the following definition gives. So, let's suppose lambda is a partition of n. standard, and basically in this class we just will have standard tableaus, but there are semi-standard tableaus in more advanced topics, so that's why the standard is there. A standard Young tableau. Yeah, and Young, oh, I didn't mention, this is not because it's not old, but this is named after a person, Alfred Young, English mathematician, worked about 100 years ago. Is a Young diagram of shape lambda, into whose boxes the numbers 1 up to n are entered. Every number exactly once. And what we want is that every row and every column, every row and every column is strictly increasing. So, for example, here you can verify in every row and in every column the numbers are increasing. So that is an example of a Young tableau. It is not the only possible Young tableau for this shape. For example, we could switch the positions of 2 and 3 and we would have a perfectly good Young tableau as well. And there are other numbers, you could switch the 7 and 10, and there are many more. And basically the question we want to look at first is, how many of these Young tableaus are there? That doesn't look obviously like something where you can immediately write down a number. So, let me mention briefly why does one care about these things? Well, it turns out the theory of these objects is really, really nice, and there are some surprising and quite interesting results about them. They are these tableaus turn out to be a crucial tool for looking at permutations, or things which have to do with permutations. So what we will do after this section is to look at symmetric polynomials, and it turns out that the tableaus give us in some cases a nice way to describe certain classes of symmetric functions. They are a crucial tool for what is called the representation theory of the symmetric group. These are homomorphisms from the symmetric group into matrix groups, into groups of matrices, for symmetric group of one particular degree into groups of matrices, and essentially one can calculate these using the tableaus. So that is one reason. The other reason is they are a generalization of things which we've done before. So let me just note, and that is something which I believe is in the homeworks. In the homework, let's suppose lambda is n squared, n2, right? So as a partition of 2n. So this is a partition into two parts of size n. Okay. How many tableaus do I have there? There are C n plus 1, where this is the Catalan number,
tableaus of this shape.
So, counting numbers of tableaus is something
which generalizes the Catalan numbers and in that way fits in what we're doing. So I can just also define this count. F lambda is the number of tableaus of shape lambda. So, for example, let's say we take lambda is 2, 1. How many tableaus do I have? Well, I have 3 cells, so I need to put the numbers 1, 2, 3. Right? The number 1 needs to be always in the uppermost left corner, right? Because it can't, since we're strictly increasing, it can't have anything to the left and anything to the top. And I can put a 2 here and a 3 there, or I can put a 3 here and a 2 there, and that's the 2 possible tableaus. So in this case, I have that this F lambda is simply equal to 2. If I take even more degenerate case, a tableau which for a shape where I have just 1 cell or all cells of size 1, then I have exactly 1 tableau. Right? Because that's the only way how I can write numbers in one row is to put them in the natural order if I want to increase them. Yeah, let's pick a slightly more interesting example. Let's say we have lambda is 4, 2, 1. What can I do there? I can put a 1, or do I get a, let's make it 411 because I'm slightly scared how many we get otherwise. So I can put a 1 here. I need to put a 2 somewhere. I can put the 2 here, or I can put the 2 here, right? Then I need to put a 3. If I put the 2 here, I can put the 3 here, or I can put the 3 here. If I have the 2 here, I can put the 3 here, or... I can put it... 1, 2... I can put the 3 there. Okay. Now, the 4, I can put a 4 here, or I can put it down. 1, 2, 3, 4. Here I can put the 4 here or there. So I get 1, 2, 4, and 1, 2, 3, 4. Here I can put the 4 here or down there. And here I can put the 4 there, or I can put it down and have 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. In total, I have 6 cells, so I need to place 5 and 6. Well, placing 5. No, sorry, I can't do that here. I can't do that, right? Because I have 4, 1, 1, there isn't a space here. Sorry, so this I already don't need to. So there I only can place the 4. Here actually, that's basically here I'm completely done. Once I have the 3 down, I can place the other numbers simply to the right.
So this must be 1456, 1256, 1356. Here I can place the 5 here or there. So if I place the 5 down, the 6 needs to go there. Or I can place 1342, I can place the 5 here and the 6 there. Here I'm done with the first row. So the 5 has to be down there and the 6 has to be down here. Okay, and now with these two, here I can place again, I can place the 5 here and the 6 here, or I can place 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and place the 6 here. And here I can place the 5, 6, or I can have 1, 2, 4, 6, 3, 5. Okay, and that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So in this case we have F lambda is 10.
So for a concrete lambda, it's not that hard to calculate it if the lambda is small enough. But if you have a lambda like this here, you probably don't want to do this. And what we will do is we will get to a formula which is called the Hooke formula, which is a nice, concise way of calculating how many tableaus are there of a given shape. Great. That's all for today. Thank you very much. And I'll see you on Wednesday.